Welcome to the Ripple Revolution Podcast. In this podcast, we take a new look at how we think about making a difference, with an approach that integrates the personal development work we do in our own lives and the difference we make in the world. Today's guest is best-selling author Gretchen Rubin. When Gretchen's book, Happier at Home, hit the New York Times bestseller list earlier this year, it had familiar company in Gretchen's first happiness-focused book, The Happiness Project, which, as of now, has been on the bestseller list for over 2 years.
Hello, Gretchen. I am so excited to finally have a chance to talk to you here. We've been on each other's radar screens for, I was trying to figure out how long it's been. When did you start blogging?
2006.
2006. So that was a good long time ago. It's just been completely inspiring to watch your trajectory from just starting your blog through best-selling books and all kinds of people impacted out there in the world. So it's been a lot of fun, and it's good to finally talk to you.
Yeah.
More ear to ear.
Yes, exactly.
So let's start off just with kind of the whole Happiness Project idea. What was that, and how did that start?
Well, I had this very ordinary experience where I was sitting on a city bus in the pouring rain, and I had one of those rare opportunities for reflection that you don't usually get in everyday life. And I thought, what do I want from life anyway? I thought, I want to be happy. But I realized I didn't spend any time thinking about whether I was happy or how I could be happier. So in a flash, I decided I'm going to have a happiness project. And that was the phrase I used for myself. I ran out the next day to the library, got this giant stack of books, and started to research, you know, can you make yourself happier? What could I do to make myself happier? And at first, it was just going to be for me. It was just something that I was doing in my own life. But before long, I realized that it was such rich material, and it was so interesting that I wanted to write a book about it. So I wrote The Happiness Project. And then, you know, flash forward a couple years, I'm still thinking and writing all the time about happiness, and I had a similar sort of epiphany experience when I was unloading the dishwasher one day, and I was hit by this crazy wave of homesickness, which was weird because I was standing in the middle of my own home with my family right there. And that got me thinking really about the idea of home and how I had not understood how home is a very critical, like it's a lens through which you can look at happiness, because if you're not happy at home, it's very hard to be happy when you're outside of your home. And home includes work and time and body and possessions and neighborhood and family, and it all comes together. So I wanted to go much more deeply into the areas related to home. So that's how I got started on this subject.
Excellent. So it sounds like it was it started off as an interest, and then just realizing it's so deep and pithy that there needed to be more.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
When you were starting out, you were talking about wanting to focus on ordinary happiness.
Mm-hmm.
Which I thought was an interesting way of thinking about that. So what is that, and why did you make that distinction as you were starting out?
Well, I think in my mind, there's happiness, unhappiness, and depression. And sometimes people think of depression as being sort of extreme unhappiness. And I think for many people, it's really quite different. It's really its own separate category and is a very grave situation, needs all kind of expert attention. So I wanted to be clear that I wasn't talking about, I've since actually heard from a lot of people who do suffer from depression who find this helpful, but I don't feel like that's what I'm aiming at. I was aiming at just the ordinary experience of life. And what I found for myself, certainly, and this seems to be true of a lot of people, is there's a lot of people, and they may be pretty happy already, where once you really focus on it and think about it and use mindfulness to think about your everyday experience, there's a lot of low-hanging fruit. There's a lot of things that you can do without a lot of time, energy, or money that can really make quite a significant difference. But you have to have the thought that you're going to try to find what those things are and then pursue them. And, you know, I love radical happiness projects like Elizabeth Gilbert moving to India and Thoreau moving to Walden Pond. And, you know, I love that, reading about that. But that was that. I'm not very adventurous. That kind of thing does not appeal to me personally. Plus, I have my work. I have two kids. I have all my responsibilities. Even if I wanted to go do something like that, I really wouldn't be able to. So I needed to focus, and I wanted to focus on just the ordinary day, just everyday life. And just what the common experience of mankind is and what you could do. I think you can learn a lot by looking at sort of extreme examples, but then I think, you know, there's also a lot to be done by just thinking about what's sort of the ordinary.
Right, right. And I think that's one of the things that I've found so powerful about what you've done over these last few years with these two books is it's really not about you've got to make these basically create this dramatic new life where you go, wow, where did this come from? It really happens right in the here and now of where you are.
Yes. Yeah. And I think, you know, and funnily enough, I think when you get a better handle on your everyday life, I think that a lot of times allows people to make bigger changes. Somebody said to me, I cleaned out my fridge and now I feel like I can change careers. There's sometimes like just getting better control over the little things in your life that makes you feel more free to make bigger changes. Especially weirdly, I've been very struck by this over and over again, is there's a weird connection for a lot of people between outer order and inner calm and inner creativity. And if you feel like, you know, a lot of people say they get, you know, they clean their closets and then all of a sudden they feel like they have so much more space and energy to think and to take risks and to try new things. There's just something about unburdening yourself of a lot of clutter and chaos in your stuff that makes you feel more in control of what's in your mind.
Absolutely, absolutely. And that's one of the things, it sounds like, just with the happier at home, that the home base is really where it all starts.
Yeah, and I think for a lot of people, we have all these high expectations for our home. You know, we want it to be a place of privacy, but also a place of engagement, and we want it to make us feel safe, but we also want it to help us take risks, and we want it to be calming, but we also want it to be a place that energizes us. So we have all of these desires that we want from home, but then for a lot of people, and certainly for me, it's kind of an afterthought. Or you just sort of, you do a lot of things by default or just out of habit or just automatically and don't think about, well, what are some of the changes that I can make? For example, one of the things that I did that was surprisingly fun and really helpful was to cultivate a shrine, which means just like create places of super engagement in your home. So like I love children's literature, love it. And I read it as a child, I read it as an adult. And so I had all these works of children's literature, but they were here and they were there and, you know, some on the floor. Like there was no particular organization to it. So I made a place in my apartment where like it's a special area. All the children's books are there, alphabetized with like my little mementos of children's literature, like my Gryffindor banner that a friend bought me, and my old Cricket magazines from when I was a child. And so now, it's not that I own anything that I didn't own before. I owned all these things before, but now they're arranged in this mindful way. And now I go in there and I'm like, oh my gosh, I love this. Like, it makes me so happy, and I love to put the books away, and I can always find what I want. And when somebody comes in, it's also one of the things that's pleasing to us about our possessions and our home is they allow us to you know, exhibit our personality and to show ourselves to the people who come there and to ourselves. And so here it is on display. Here's my love. Of somebody I know who loves tango. When people come in, she's got a big shelf of tango shoes. So you come in and you're like, this is a lady who likes to tango, you know, and she likes that that's right there in somebody's face when they come in because that's an important part of her identity for her. So whether it's wine or France or arts and crafts or music or tools or whatever it is, you know, it's something that can make your experience more of home more energized, more fun. But it's not like you have to spend a lot of time or money to do it. It's just thinking about what you've already got, what's already important to you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and which leads into another question that I have. You have these 12 personal commandments. which I love. And one of those is probably my favorite one is Be Gretchen.
Oh, that's my favorite one too. That's the first one.
So there is this aspect of authenticity, and that's why what made me think there's this lead into that particular question. There's this aspect of authenticity with that Be Gretchen. Can you share a little bit about what the impact of that has been and why that's important?
Well, you know, it's funny because people will often say to me, like, well, what is the key to happiness? You know, like, tell me the one thing. And I think there's a couple different answers that you can give to that are right, just depending on what perspective you're using to examine happiness. But certainly one of them is self-knowledge. You could say self-knowledge is the key to happiness, because we can be happy only if our lives are based on the foundation of our own nature, our own interests, our own values. And the more I've done to bring my life into harmony with my own nature, my own values, my own true interests, the happier I get. And you think, well, what could be easier than to know yourself? You hang out with yourself all day long. But it's hard. It's hard to know yourself. I think this is the great challenge of life. Because you know, it's so easy to think about what you wish you were like, or what other people think you ought to be like, or what you assume is true of everyone, and really lose track of what's true for you. And so one of the things I think is like those children's literature. For a long time, I kind of denied this about myself because it didn't fit my image of myself as a sophisticated, very discerning reader. But you know what? It's like, this is what I love. And now that I've shown a spotlight on it, it's a much bigger and more fun area of my life. I've made all these friends through it, and because I really allowed it to be an important part of my identity instead of trying to pretend like it wasn't real. And then sometimes people try to pretend like something's real that's not. Like, I love skiing, or I love shopping, or I love wine, or I love the outdoors. A friend of mine said to me, well, you know me, Gretchen, I hate the outdoors. And I love that. I was like, you hate the outdoors. Okay, well, that shows you what you want in life. There's a lot of things that you don't need to spend your time worrying about because you hate the outdoors. But it can be sad to sort of admit these things about ourselves. Like, it was sad for me to kind of realize, I just don't care very much about music. I mean, I like a good song here, you know, just, you know, what, casually. But for so many people, this is a very important passion, really significant pleasure in their life. And it's just not for me. I wish it were, and I used to kid myself and think if I would only spend more time on it or learn more or spend more time listening to music, then I would love it. You know, but I got a lot of things I love without having to work at it. And I just had to let go of this fantasy of myself as one day being somebody who would have a deep appreciation for music. And then I have more time for the things that are important to me because I don't have to pretend like I want to spend time fussing with music. So it can be sad, but it's also a huge relief, and it also lets you spend more time on the things that you like. But and there's a paradox there, though, because on the one hand, you want to accept yourself. But then on the other hand, you want to expect more from yourself. And so one of the big challenges for me always is I want to be Gretchen. I want to accept myself. But I also don't want to accept sometimes my limits. I want to push myself to be better and to expect more for myself. And sometimes it's not easy to tell what's something that's within your nature and something that just is not within your nature. It can be tricky sometimes to figure that out.
Have you learned any tips as far as how to approach that paradox management?
Well, one thing that's funnily enough that's helpful in a lot of situations, surprisingly, is to think of yourself in the third person. So to say to yourself, okay, like I was very scared of driving. I hate to drive. I'm a very scared driver. Like, long story, but anyway, and for Happier at Home, that book, I was thinking, should I have one of my resolutions be to get over this fear of driving? And I was like, well, is it just part of who I am that I really don't like to drive and I should just let it go and not worry about it? Or is this something that I can really expect for myself? And so I was sort of struggling with that. Now, hint, I really wanted to decide that I didn't need to worry about it. That's what I wanted to think. Because it was scary. I didn't want to do it. And then one of the questions I asked myself is, like, is it reasonable to expect Gretchen to drive? And automatically I'd be like, yes, of course it's reasonable to expect Gretchen to drive. She knows how to drive. She's a perfectly good driver. There's no reason that she should not be driving. So just thinking about yourself in the third person, like, is it reasonable to expect this person to da 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 da? And then, because it'll reflect a sense of yourself, of what you think is possible for you. And here's another thing. It's a really helpful question. Is the question to say, choose the bigger life. And that's a helpful question because a lot of times two people could look at a decision and make different decisions. Because for them, the bigger life, like I know somebody who was trying to decide whether to have a child. Now, and she had this very busy career as a doctor. Now, for some people, choosing a bigger life would mean don't have the baby. And for some people, choosing a bigger life would mean do have the baby. But so it's you who decide, because the phrase bigger life means only what you think it means. So it's a good way of bringing your own values to bear on it. Because if you're like, now this is the bigger life, well, then that tells you something about your values and interests. And if you're like, well, no, that's the bigger life, well, then that tells, you know, what's the bigger life? To go camping or go to Berlin and spend the whole time going to museums? What is the bigger life for you? I think most people would say they know what the bigger life is for them. So that can be helpful as well.
Absolutely. Now, it's interesting with the self-knowledge piece. It seems like it should be a no-brainer, but as you point out, it's not that easy.
No.
It's not something that we spend a lot of time with. The thing that I always say is, when was the last time you saw an Introspection 101 class?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so if we're experiencing something, we recognize whether it's on or it's off, et cetera. But being able to articulate it so that we can make decisions gets more challenging.
Yep. Absolutely.
So one of the things I had seen an interview and there was with you, and there was a question about whether there was pressure, that you felt pressure to be happy after all the success of your happiness projects and such. And you said, well, no, not really. You know, I've had the happiness, I've had the unhappiness. It's just kind of the normal human experience, and I haven't really felt like I shouldn't have those.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, haven't really felt like I shouldn't have the unhappiness. And I thought that was really important because one of the things that seems to happen, and this is one of the things that I think is the downside of the whole self-help personal development industry, is there's this tendency to kind of paint life as supposed to be this shiny, happy place and nothing but this shiny, happy place. And then so if people feel down or something's going off, they feel like something's wrong. So could you talk a little bit about, in your experience of things, the importance of really accepting the full range of life's experience?
You know, you make a very astute point. I mean, one of the things that I think is helpful is to not think about achieving happiness, but to think about being happier. Because achieving happiness suggests that there's like this threshold that you cross, and you're going to cross the finish line, and then everything is going to be different. And how do you stay there 24/7? And is that possible? And you know, I don't think that's possible. I don't even think it would be a good life. And it's like that's not even. Like, don't worry about that. I think it's more helpful to think about being happier. Because if you know, you're thinking about doing something in your life, and you think next week, next month, next year, is this something that's going to make me happier? And that's more realistic because, you know, it's all about are you moving in the right direction, not about hitting some finish line. And I also think that you're exactly right. Some people sort of act like what I'm advocating for is for everyone to be 10 on the 1 to 10 scale 24/7, which, again, I don't think is realistic. I don't think it would be a good life. And actually, negative emotions are incredibly important and helpful in trying to have a happier life. And things like guilt and regret and envy and boredom are really important clues to changes that you might want to make in your life that could make you happier. So, for instance, envy. Envy is an incredibly painful emotion. People really do not like to feel envious, and they don't even like to admit that they feel envious often. But it's very helpful to clue in to your own feelings of envy. And when I was a lawyer and thinking about switching to writing, one of the things that was very persuasive to me was I was looking at the alumni bulletin from my college and reading about people that I knew. And I noticed that when I read about people who had cool law jobs, I felt a kind of mild interest. But when I read about people who had cool writing jobs, I felt sick with envy. And that taught me that's what I wanted for myself, you know, and so it was very helpful. Or something like, you know, if you're really bored with something, instead of trying to pretend, you know, really say to yourself, oh, this is really boring for me. Is there a way for me to make it interesting, or is there a way for me to avoid doing it altogether? You know, can I throw money at the problem? Can I change my job? Can I, you know, by paying close attention to negative emotions, guilt. I mean, guilt shows you that in some ways your actions don't reflect your values. That's a very important thing to know about yourself. I think that wanting to be a happier person doesn't mean that, you know, you never feel negative emotions. And but I just think it's a shame if people aren't as happy as they can be given their circumstances. Certainly there's times for all of us where we're not happy and it wouldn't even be right to be happy. We wouldn't even want to be happy. You know, your mother's in the hospital and you're very, very sad and upset, but can you be as happy as you can be under the circumstances? Because I think a lot of times if you do what you can, then you give yourself more emotional wherewithal. Because, like, who's more helpful? The person who's so upset that their mother's in the hospital that they stay up all night, they don't eat, they run themselves ragged, they don't take a break at all. After 2 weeks, they're going to be a basket case. Or the person who's like, I'm under a lot of stress, I need to get my sleep, I need to make sure that I eat breakfast, I need to give myself a little break and watch a rerun of The Office on television and give myself a little bit of a mental break. Over time, that's the person who's going to be able to manage that situation better for themselves and then for the people around them too. So I think when you think about, like, well, how can I manage the way I'm feeling? Not just let it flow over me, but really sort of think about, okay, well, what can I do given the circumstances? I may not feel happy, but maybe I can feel better, and probably I'll handle things better if I feel better.
Right. And sometimes it's just a question of kind of that whole mindfulness thing.
Oh yeah, that's the key right there. Yep.
So, but let's talk a little bit about that and the impact of that.
Well, I'm a good, I'm like the least mindful person in the world, so it's a struggle for me. I think you put your finger right on it. I think that really so much of this just comes down to, like, paying attention. What's true for you? How do you actually feel right now? Like, what's the effect of this on you? Why are you feeling energized, or why are you feeling overwhelmed, or, you know, what's happening? Because once you're mindful enough, then you can see ways that you can make changes. And as I said, I think a lot of times these changes are not huge. I think sometimes, like, here's an example. So I was paying it because I was working on Happier at Home. I was paying a lot of attention to my circumstances, my environment when I was at home. And I noticed that my family had fallen into a bad habit, and that was when people would come and go from our apartment. Nobody really paid that much attention. Like, we would sort of grunt out, like, without looking up from our homework or our iPad or the newspaper or the book or whatever. And I was just as bad as everybody else. But I thought, you know, this is not the experience that I want to have with my family coming and going. I want us to have a tender, attentive atmosphere at home. So I said, like, and this is one of the few times where I really had a resolution that applied to any more than just me. Usually these resolutions are just for me. But I said, what if we were going to give warm greetings and farewells every time somebody came and left? And everybody agreed. Everybody knew what I was talking about. And now everybody gets a warm greeting and farewell every time they come and go. It doesn't take a lot of time, energy, or money. I didn't have to do a lot of nagging. It's a very easy habit to acquire. And it makes a huge difference in the atmosphere of home if every time you walk in or leave, you get a hug or a kiss, or people really pay attention to you. So it wasn't a hard change to make, even though other people were involved, which makes it harder. But I had to notice that was what was happening, and I had to think it through and think, how could I make this different? What would make my situation better? And so the mindfulness is how you see an opportunity and understand what needs to change. Without mindfulness, we're all so overwhelmed with everything happening to us. It's like it does take effort to sort of tease out what are the different things that are happening and how they could be different. It's not hard to do, but you have to do it. So in a way, it is hard because you have to go through that process. So that's what I hope that I do, is I help people just see things that are right there, but that maybe they haven't quite noticed. But then once I point it out, they're like, oh, yeah, I would totally do that, or, yeah, that would be easy for me, or I never thought that would make a difference, but I'll give it a try and see if it makes, you know, does making my bed make me any happier? I'll try, and I'll see what happens. That's a silly thing, but a lot of people swear by making their bed.
But and I think back to the clutter or lack of clutter. Mm-hmm. I certainly noticed the difference just in how my brain visually responds to what's around me. One of the things that I love to talk about, and I especially love to talk about it with people that so much of what they talk about is focused on really the upside of things and the bright side of things, there's this aspect of FUD, this fear, uncertainty, doubt, the kind of the things that close us down that we often don't really want to even acknowledge exists, but we all feel it, and we all run into things, and we all run into things to just shut us down and slow us down and stop us. When you run into fear, when you run into that feeling of uncertainty, that doubt about what it is that you're doing or you know, your ability or whatever it happens to be, so fear, uncertainty, doubt, what works for you to navigate through that? How do you tend to do that?
Well, one thing, I have a mantra that is very helpful to me, which is to enjoy the fun of failure. Because I'm a person who does not like to fail, and I realize, like, if you're not failing, you're not trying hard enough, and so you have to really embrace it. So I try to call it the fun of failure, to sort of remind myself, like, this is what I should expect, not everything's going to work out, enjoy the fun of failure. And it was interesting, because I wrote about this on my blog, and somebody posted back and said, you shouldn't call it failure, you should reframe it and see it as a positive. And at first I thought that was right, and then I'm like, no, that's exactly wrong, because I don't want to pretend to myself that I didn't fail, because that's just pretending, that's just going deeper into this idea that it's not permissible to fail or that I have to pretend like I didn't fail. I want to embrace the idea of failure and say it's fine to fail. That's good. Like, and just, but what I always say to myself is, like, what have I learned from this? What have I learned from this? Because to fail without learning, it's just, it's like, what, there's no benefit from it. There's no gain made. But to learn from a failure is extremely valuable. And I had a boss a long time ago who would quote Benjamin Franklin saying, experience keeps a dear school, but a fool has no other. And that is really true. I mean, I think it's very hard to learn from success, and it's very hard to learn when things go right. And when things go wrong, you can learn a lot. And so I always I try to say, like, this is what happened, and so now what do I know that I didn't know before? What can I do differently next time? And so then it feels like it's still helping me, you know. One thing that I often do, too, is sort of I say to myself, life is long, meaning, like, maybe this didn't work, maybe that didn't work, but life is long. I have, you know, many things will come and go. You know, there's many opportunities, and over the course of years, there's a lot of room for experiments that don't work out, relationships that don't work out, and you know, just learn from it and move on. But it's hard. It is hard because people, we don't want to feel afraid. We don't want uncertainty. We don't want to fail.
So it sounds like a lot of it is really about perspective.
Yes, yes, absolutely. That's a very succinct way of putting it, yes. Trying to find ways to get myself into that frame of mind where I'm able to have perspective instead of getting sucked into. But one thing I do, and I imagine you struggle with this too, is part of being online is the feedback, which can be fantastic, but it can also be harsh. And so one thing I do is I don't expose myself to situations where I know that I'm likely to encounter very high levels of snarkiness, because I feel like it affects me very deeply. I take it very hard. It doesn't help me. It's not constructive criticism that's going to make me stronger and better. It's criticism that's going to make me defensive and afraid to take risks and feeling like if I flop a toe over a line, somebody's going to hit it with a hammer. So, for example, I don't read reviews on Amazon because maybe some people like it, maybe some people hate it. Like, you know, a strong, and I remind myself, a strong voice repels as well as attracts. Not everybody's going to like what I do. That's okay. But I have to do what I have to do what's right for me. I have to be Gretchen. But I don't go out of my way to expose myself to criticism, you know, that's from people that I don't know, and I don't know what their agenda is. I don't know where they're coming from. I try, it's hard, but I try very hard to accept, and I do accept a lot of constructive criticism from people who I respect. But that's people where I know that they're being thoughtful, and I know where they're coming from. Because I think to just kind of cruise around, like if you're doing something where you might be in a situation where you might get a lot of feedback from people that you don't know exactly where that's coming from, I think it can be really brutal for some people. And it seems like sometimes the people who are the most sensitive to it are the most drawn to it. I mean, I have a friend, I'm like, girl, why are you reading that stuff? Turn it off. Like, you know it's just going to upset you. And she's like, I just can't help myself. I'm like, well, figure it out. Chain yourself to your just stay out of there. Don't look at that stuff, because it's not making you a stronger, better writer, and it's actually, you know, it's really, it's upsetting you. So it's not helping. It's not failure in a good way. It's just it's upsetting to no constructive end, I find. I don't know about you, but that's what I find.
And so bringing that to kind of a broader perspective for writers and non-writers alike, it's really being discerning about what you allow into your brain.
Yes, absolutely. So here's something that I've been thinking about a lot for my next book, which is about habits. There's a certain kind of person that I've noticed who's attracted to what I would call potato chip news. So it's news that doesn't have a lot of news value to it. It tends to be very repetitive and redundant. So it's natural disasters, true crime, political punditry, celebrity gossip, where there's a lot of coverage and there's a lot of color. It's often very sensationalized. It's on television. And some people get very, very, very upset by it. You know, like they'll watch the footage of a natural disaster and they'll be so upset by what's happening. And they're not learning more information because they know the information. They're not being moved to action. So it's not like they're watching it and now they're going out and volunteering. It's like they get sucked into it and they can't get out of it. But often the people, again, who are most attracted to it are the people who are the most upset by it. Like somebody who said, well, I tried to quit smoking, but then Katrina happened. But she was completely personally unaffected by Katrina. It was just the idea of Katrina, which she was like spending hours watching, was so upsetting to her that she couldn't quit smoking. Well, you know, I'm like, you need to like turn off the television then, you know, and like maybe read the newspaper instead of watching it on TV, because people don't tend to like read a newspaper for 5 hours, but they will watch CNN for 5 hours. Again, it's like manage what's coming in. If you're very deeply upset by things, ask yourself, what am I really gaining out of this? Am I gaining knowledge? Am I being moved to act? Am I, or am I just drawn to it in some way that's not healthy for me? I'm not saying that it's wrong to do it. I'm just saying that for a lot of people, it seems to really unsettle them and affect them in ways that are very negative in their own life, but sort of, you know, but it's not clear why they're doing it. I remember with the Bernie Madoff scandal, I found myself reading profile after profile of the people who had been affected. And then I realized, like, I'm not learning anything here, and I'm not doing anything. It's just making me really, really sad and upset. Like, I should take action or do something or turn it off, because it's upsetting me to no end. That it's not going anywhere that's positive. It's just it felt self-indulgent for me. It had become kind of self-indulgent.
Yeah, I think that's a really good distinction there of asking the question: is this moving me to action? Am I learning something, or is it simply creating emotion in me? Emotion in me.
Yeah, and I mean, one thing to always say is like, I can read about it instead of watching it on TV, because the thing about reading is always more. It's less emotionally, you know, it doesn't have the same kind of emotional hit, and it tends to be more self-limiting. So if you feel like, well, it's really important to me to keep up with everything that's happening, we'll say, okay, well, I'm going to read about it in the newspaper. Or I'm going to watch a half an hour of television, but to find some way to limit it so that it doesn't just take over your life. I mean, I saw a comment where somebody was like, I was so worried about the outcome of the election that I ate half a pan of peanut butter brownies. Well, there's just no connection between those things. This person had worked themselves into such a frenzy that they lost self-control in a way that was very unhelpful for them, clearly, and that bothered them because they mentioned it. But it's like, why? Clearly this is not good for you, And yet, and how much are you learning about the election or about the issues from what you're watching? You know, I would say probably not a lot. So read it in the newspaper. You'll be very educated. You'll know everything you want to know, but you won't have that emotional hit that can be very unsettling.
Yeah, and you have a lot more control over how much you take in.
Yes, absolutely, because we just don't binge. We don't go into that bad trance with reading as much, where you just sit there kind of with your mouth open, late into the night, too tired to turn it off. I mean, the bad trance. Beware. That's mindfulness. Beware of the bad trance. If you are too tired to do anything except watch TV, go to bed. You know?
And that's actually pretty significant advice.
I mean, I'm just on this campaign to try to help people go to bed earlier. I mean, there's true night people. But one of the ways you know if you're a true night person is, are you energetic and creative and working? I mean, I have a friend who's a novelist. You know, she's like, 2:00, I'm at my best. That's when I'm productive. I'm creative. I'm so energized. I'm so focused. That's a true night person. But I think there's a lot of people, at least among my friends, they say they're night people because they stay up late. But if they, for some reason, they have an occasion, like they just have to go to bed earlier, or like they lie down next to their child when they're putting them to bed, they fall asleep right away. So it's not like they're jacking themselves up to stay awake because they like being awake, they like the leisure, or they enjoy whatever they're doing, but they would actually go to sleep. A true night person can't go to sleep. A true night person is wide awake and getting stuff done. But the slack-jawed, law and order, rerun, falling asleep in front of the television, you know, put on your PJs, go to bed.
Time better used.
Yeah.
So a last question. We're talking about, you created your own happiness project, and you talk about how other people can create their own happiness project. What tips do you have? So somebody out there is listening to this, and they say, wow, you know what? That sounds like a really cool idea to start bringing some of that, more of that into my life and exploring that. What tips do you have for people for getting started with their own happiness project?
Well, one thing I would say is that when you're trying to think of changes that you want to make, it's very helpful to be very concrete. Because when you're very concrete, you know what you're asking of yourself, and you can measure whether you're doing it or not. So a lot of times I think people want to make change, but they're too vague. So they don't see what they should be doing. So, for example, eating healthy. That is too vague. What does that mean? It's better to say things like, I'm going to eat a salad for lunch every day. I'm going to bring my lunch from home every day. I'm going to eat dinner. I'm not going to eat after 8 p.m. I'm going to eat 5 servings of vegetables every day, or whatever you would think would be eating healthy. Spell it out and then keep track. That's another thing, is say to yourself, okay, I'm going to do this. Make a chart or use an app or whatever works for you in terms of just saying, like, are you actually doing that? So you want to make it very concrete. You want to have some kind of accountability. So something like, I want to get more joy out of life. Well, that's so abstract as to be meaningless. What would give you, I want to start a book group. I want to watch a classic movie every Sunday night on television. I want to cook every Saturday night. I want to play with my dog in my backyard every night when I come home from work. Whatever, like, what would actually help you get more joy out of life? Like, put it into very concrete terms and then say to yourself, okay, I said that I was going to rent a classic movie every Sunday night. Am I doing it? Okay, a month has gone by. Have I seen 4 classic movies? Yes or no? And if time goes by and you're unable to keep it, then you need to figure out, like, well, do I need another form of external accountability, which is very important for a lot of people, or is this, for some reason, this doesn't work, and I need to think of a different resolution to achieve my goal? And this comes back again to this idea of self-knowledge. It's really important to be very true to yourself when you're trying to figure out what resolutions to make, because they really have to be what's right for you. So say something like exercise. A lot of people will say to me, like, oh, I need to exercise. I'm going to start running in the morning before I go to work. And then I say, well, okay, are you a night person or a morning person? Do you want more solitude or would you like more time with friends? Do you like music? Do you like to be outside? Are you very put off by bad weather? Because you think if a person who is craved for to have more time with friends, who hates the cold, who's very worried about slipping and sliding because they broke their hip 10 years ago, and is a night person, like, you're not going to go running in the morning. Like, don't kid yourself. It's not going to happen. Like, you need to go to a class after work with your best friend, and, you know, when it's inside. And, you know, so I think people sometimes don't spend enough time thinking about the match. How can they do the resolution in a way that matches their temperament and their interests? You know, you hear about a friend who has a great Pilates class, and you're like, okay, I'll do it. It's like, well, think about it for a minute. Is this the right approach for you? It might be great, but maybe something else would work better. Because it's great to catch a goal or a habit from someone else, and that can often happen and be very exciting and terrific. But then sometimes we try to adopt things that aren't right for us, and then we get frustrated when we can't do it. And for everyone, like, you know, with my happiness project, there were a lot of things that I didn't think about at all that would have been really important for other people, like music. As I said, I'm not that interested in music. For some people, bringing more music into their life might have been a very important goal. Or adventure. You know, for some people, travel is of huge value. And even, like, going to new restaurants and trying new things, they love that. And it's really important to them. And their happiness project, that might be one of their most important aspects that they consider. That's not very important for me. So I didn't do it. I didn't worry about it. So again, it's like, think about yourself, think about what's important to you, think about how you could be happier, and really try to put it into concrete terms. If traveling is important to you, what exactly does that mean? Are you going to save? Are you going to plan? Are you going to talk to a friend? Are you going to make reservations? Like, you know, figure it out. Like, break it down and really figure out the resolutions that will help you make that happen in your everyday life.
Excellent. And on the accountability piece, one of the quick piece of how I've done things, I find that I'm my motivation really takes a page out of the kindergarten handbook. Mm-hmm. And I was trying to incorporate what I called the four pillars of well-being with drinking enough water, getting exercise every day, eating my fruits and vegetables, and meditating every day. And I made this chart with these four columns for each of those. And then I had these stars that I got to put. Mm-hmm. I did it in
yep,
that
there you go.
I got to put a star on.
Yeah.
And you would not believe how motivated I was.
I completely agree. I am a gold star junkie and find that kind of thing very, very helpful. It's interesting because in my next book, I have something I call foundation. And my foundation is different from your foundation, but it's the same idea, which is like, deal with these first things first, and then other things, it'll be a lot easier to work on the other things.
Yep, absolutely. Oh, yeah. I have had so much fun talking to
you.
Me
too. I feel like we could talk all afternoon. This is great.
Absolutely, absolutely. So let's wrap up now. When I would like to make sure that people can find you and find more about all of your great juicy ideas. So could you share a website, a place that people can find out more about what you're up to?
Absolutely. There is more about happiness than you could ever read on my site, which is called The Happiness Project, which is happiness-project.com. And I also have a Facebook page where I start a lot of happiness conversations, and that's just Gretchen Rubin, my name, R-U-B-I-N. And I'm on Twitter at Gretchen Rubin, and on Pinterest, and I have a YouTube channel. But you can get to all those things through my website, Happiness Project. And then I have one thing that people might enjoy, it's very, very popular, is I have a daily newsletter that has a happiness quotation, you know, whether it's Tolstoy or Benjamin Franklin or Thoreau or whomever, it's a daily quotation just so you start your day with a little bit of a, you know, something to think about, the moment of happiness. So you can also sign up for that through my blog. So there's a lot there for people who are interested in the subject.
Excellent, excellent. Well, I definitely appreciate your time and your insights, and I am coming away from this feeling like I'm just ready to go out there and make the world happen.
Excellent.
So I appreciate it all, and I've enjoyed it immensely. So
great. Well, great to talk to you. Have a great day.
Take care.